Hello everyone and welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. My name's Faiton Stow and I'm the founder of Innovation Bay. These podcasts are a new initiative by us here aimed at doing a deep dive with our network around all themes entrepreneurship and technology. We hope you're enjoying them so far and we welcome any feedback. Today, we are speaking to the CEO of 99 Designs, Patrick Llewellyn, focusing on international expansion and US funding.
Hi, Patrick.
G'day, Faiton. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks, Mace. Look, a quick little bio on you. I'm sure everyone knows who you are, but you're the CEO of 99 Designs. You've been in that role since 2011. You moved to the US and have been in San Francisco for the last 5 years.
Seven years.
You moved over from Melbourne to drive the company's international expansion. You led and organized the $35 million A round with Accel Partners, mm-hmm. and then the strategic round following that of $10 million with Recruit out of Japan.
Yep.
You've helped the company expand globally, including a number of acquisitions in Europe and South America. You've taken the company from less than 10 people to over 120 and revenues of over 60 million US, and really taken the business to now represent what is the largest marketplace for design in the world, which is an incredible effort.
Mostly to do with my team's effort and the community's effort, and you know, I got to be taken along for the ride, so I'm very grateful.
Yeah, well, let's learn a little bit more about that. Now, you're born and raised in Melbourne?
Yep, that's right. A Melbourne boy, grew up in the Dandenong Ranges.
And I know that you were in strategic consulting, mm-hmm. which is sort of advisory, is that
yeah.
right? Is
yeah,
that
what I'm saying? But- yeah, so most of my experience before 99 Design, so like generally Bachelor of Business, fairly generic. First job out of school was, you know, really in the only economic downturn we've had. So that's, I'm dating myself. Yes, I'm pretty old, but the one downturn we have had in the last 25 years was when I left school. I think we're similar ages, yeah. So yeah. You understand that. So I went into a marketing internship straight out of school and then ended up found myself way into technology sales. I tried to drop out before I dropped in, so I spent a bit of time in the country and planted a vineyard and started to really get to understand the wine industry and ran a restaurant with my wife and then started consulting to the wine industry, and that then led to technology investment banking. And so that's quite a roundabout route, but wine and tech have always gone hand in hand, and it was literally just because .com one was well and truly racing everywhere and there was so much work in the technology space that I was kind of like, well, you kind of understand technology, you know, you're young enough, you worked in it, you've sold it, can you help do some work in it? And so I spent nearly 10 years in corporate advisory doing really hard stuff. Really, we're a boutique firm, so really it was helping founders raise money or, you know, sell their businesses, mostly generally on the sell side. We did a bit of buy side advisory or corporate strategic advisory sometimes to larger corporates, mostly still for sort of mid-sized, you know, what we'd call venture-backed businesses today. You know, how I came about at 99 was when I first got into advisory, I met a guy called Lenny Mayo at my first ever tech conference in Sydney. I think it was, I can't even remember the name of it now, but it was one of those famous, like Juniper or like, anyway.
The old conferences.
The old conferences, yeah. Irrelevant to most of the audience today. But Lenny had just sold a business to Sausage Software, was working inside Sausage, and was talking to me about making an investment in a friend's company, which was called SitePoint. So he was talking about Mark Harbottle, who's the founder of SitePoint. He was investing in Mark and Matt. I gave him a bit of help with his term sheet, and Lenny and I became lifelong friends. And so when I'd catch up with Lenny, he'd talk to me about how SitePoint was going, and I'd ask him questions. And so through that journey over the 2000s, I was still living in Sydney doing advisory. Lenny was in Melbourne and helping Mark grow the SitePoint team and the SitePoint business here. You know, Matt was in Vancouver, providing sort of the beginning of our North American presence there.
Mm. And what was compelling enough for you to leave?
So, I mean, it was at the GFC 2009, Mark and Lenny approached me about how SitePoint was starting to evolve, and they had spun out 99 in 2008 as a specialist marketplace for graphic design. They were about to spin out Flippa, which was a specialist marketplace for buying and selling websites. they had a couple of other embryonic ideas within the site group, point group. And so it was initially like, well, would you be interested in maybe having a look at Flipper and coming in as a sort of a general management role there? Maybe we could talk to you about looking at the group. And so I flew in, took a punt, flew in on a Sunday and spent a day with Mark. It was meant to be coffee that lasted for 4 or 5 hours.
Was there an itch there to go back into an organization, having, you know, done the winery thing?
I mean, look, I think there was definitely what happens with advisory is the fun advisory is obviously the sort of the satisfaction of doing the deal. And I really got a lot of the best fun I had in advisory was getting to really get close to founders and helping them fulfill their vision and their dream. But then I'd get so wedded to it, I'd want to keep going on the journey, and then I'd have to go again and find the next thing. And you would have experienced that in recruitment, right? You really get where you get in with you like, well, this is awesome, we're building the team, and then like, yeah, thanks, bye, your job's done, we're now together. And that was a bit like my experience in there. So I definitely got to know a lot of entrepreneurs. I sort of felt like I understand. I got to dig apart lots of business models and really understand what they'll stick. So, you know, felt like it's a great way to learn about businesses. And so when Mark and I met, what happened was we were talking about this portfolio view and trying to understand the stuff. And then the more he talked about 99, the more I got interested. And so then I spent some time thinking about it. And I was doing some advisory work in the stock photography space at that time for one of our clients in Sydney. And so I could see these parallels of what was happening in stock photography and what had happened and what I thought I was seeing pattern recognition in 99. And so, you know, Mark and I kept talking.
Was there a chemistry with you and Mark?
Yeah, for sure. And look, some of that was because back in 06, 07, Mark was keen to sell the SitePoint Group or look at a transaction there. And so I pitched my advisory capacity, and in the end he went with a US-based investment bank because he was like, look, we're a US audience, that's where our revenue comes from, that's where we'll sell. And I gave him some different advice and he kind of remembered that, and you know, my advice proved to be reasonably on point. So I think I sort of proved myself a little bit over time that, you know, I knew what I was talking about at one level. And then, yeah, we really did hit it off. But it took a long time. So it probably took us 6 months. I didn't join until September of 2009.
Okay.
And we had really then started to refine it. We're like, cool. You know, at first I told when Mark and I were kind of like really close, he was like, cool, you're going to move to Melbourne. You'll spend 18 months in Melbourne and then we'll move to the States and open our office there. And so I told Mum, we're moving home from Sydney. I'd been living up there with my wife. We had 3 kids. So, you know, 2 of them were very young. We're coming home for 18 months and then we'll move to the States.
What was aspect of moving to America? Was it an apprehension there or was that exciting?
It was both. Yeah, absolutely. And so, but then what happened was Mark and I quickly went, yeah, 18 months is too long. And so in the end, I moved in 6 weeks.
But the business had done a funding round since then.
No, we had not done anything. So
99 it was all organic.
All organic. So 99 was cash flow funded. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, like contrary to what you've been reading in the media, we were profitable in our past, right? So it was cash flow funded. SitePoint was a reasonably profitable business. And so Mark and Matt and, you know, the other like Lenny and Walshy had been funding the development of these businesses. But 99, when I joined, was self-sustaining as a small group, you know, small team. And we had a bit of a benevolent parent. I don't know if we're selling, paying for all of our services from the SitePoint group. So SitePoint would provide accounting and infrastructure and the office and all that sort of stuff. But 99 was, you know, self-sustaining when I joined. So my original roles, I moved to San Francisco in January of 2010. We already had one guy working out of his home office there. And so he and I got our first serviced office and then started hiring customer support in that market. And our whole notion was, yeah, you know, my first title was President North America. So I used to joke to my mates, it was me and Obama. I just forget the North America 99.
Very important, though, title aspect in America.
Exactly. I know. I mean, because originally Mark and I were talking about it. And I'm like, he's like, what will we call you? And I'm like, I don't know, GM North America. And he's like, nah, fuck. Yeah. You've got to come up with something that's a bit grander than that. You know, everyone's a bloody vice president. You know, they won't even know what a GM is. So we'll have to call you president. So that's how that came about.
I can imagine that the structure of that move would have been fairly frugal in terms of where the business was at that stage, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And moving across to San Francisco with three kids.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sold my house. Like, I went all in. Like, right. I sold my house in Sydney.
Wow.
Because I was worried. I mean, 99 I felt reasonably secure about, but I wasn't, you know, it still could turn on a dime.
Mm.
And so I kind of wanted to have enough cash in the bank just in case I had to come home with my tail between my legs and be able to fund the return trip.
Mm.
You know, I got a little bit of support, but it cost me a lot more than the support that I got from Mark. I hope you don't listen to this, but yeah, I mean, he knew. It cost me a lot more, but like that was part of the commitment. He was taking a bit of a punt on me. I had no real operating experience, but the reason why he picked me was he wanted someone who could help him think about future liquidity events.
Right.
And so that did happen a lot faster than any of us anticipated.
How long since you arrived to doing the deal with Excel?
So I arrived in January. We did the deal with them and we completed it in March of 2011 and announced it in April.
So was that a year?
Yeah, just over.
Right.
In that time, though, we did have like trade interest and all sorts of stuff. So it was it was much more of a transactional time than I envisaged.
How did the Excel
deal come about?
Yeah.
So this is the fun part to the story. You know, I had a lot of experience with Australian VCs and certainly the old generation of VCs. I'd like to preface that, you know, the Australian community has evolved significantly over the last 10 years plus. But when I joined 99, I kind of found, you know, talking to Mark, I realized that we'd had quite a lot of inbound VC interest because 99, the early adopters, our earlier customer segment were San Francisco-based entrepreneurs, right? So they were getting logos created or their first website created on our site. They'll go to pitch to VCs, and VCs would, the thing that they'd be impressed with most was their logo or their website. And so they'd end up talking about this amazing process that they used. And so we started to build buzz. Matt out of Vancouver did a great job of helping, you know, build that buzz. And that just meant there was a lot of inbound interest. And so I remember Mark and I were about to travel in October of 2009. Like, I just joined in September. We went in October to figure out where we might open an office and start scouting locations to live and all that sort of stuff. And he's like, oh, I don't know, should we meet with any of these VCs? And I'm like, yeah, maybe. And so they look pretty interesting. So we end up taking a few meetings. And one of them was with Excel.
Mm.
And we just went to have a coffee. And so we didn't prepare anything or anything. And then we're sitting in the you know, Excel. I don't know if you've been to the Excel offices. I think you have.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Excel offices, they had like lots of VC firms. They have, you know, it's kind of fairly nice entry and sitting way. And they always have big screens. And so then the next minute, these faces are just smiling down at you. And so it's, of course, Facebook's a very celebrated Excel portfolio company. So there's Zach looking at you and there's Drew from Dropbox. And, you know, it was just like a who's who. And all of a sudden, I could sense that me and Mark started getting quite nervous because we were like, oh, shit, these guys are a pretty big deal. And I knew that, but I think, you know,
who was the initial meeting with?
It was with Rich Wong and Andrew Braccia.
Right.
So Andrew's on my board today. Mm. And Rich is pretty famous in these parts for being, I think, the largest individual shareholder in Atlassian behind Mike and Scott.
Right.
So.
And this was the second business he'd invested in Australia, was it?
So Rich had already done the Atlassian deal. And I think they might have done Aus4x or maybe not. But anyway, maybe not at that point. I think maybe even Atlassian hadn't been done at that point. Or maybe they'd done Atlassian. This was really 2009, right? But they were starting to really scout Australia. It was a guy called Miles Clements who did the original. He was like a young junior associate straight out of uni who did the approach to Mark. And then Andrew and Rich met with us. And Andrew started just talking about our business and what we needed to do and giving me advice on where to live and where my kids might go to school and, you know, just a range of stuff. And it was really engaging, really warm. And the thing that we sort of was struck us was, well, they really understood our business immediately. God, they were so friendly. And one of their parting things was, who would you like to meet out of the portfolio? And we're like sitting there going, this is kind of a trick question. And we're like, oh, well, we love Dropbox. How about Dropbox? They're like, okay, cool. And we're like, well, we're going to New York, so how about Etsy? They're like, yeah, great. And so within the space of, I think, 24 hours, Mark and I were driving along. We got a call from Drew on our phone saying, hey, I really want to apologize. I can't fit you in. But you know, I wanted to have a quick chat to you on the phone. So we're kind of like, whoa, you know, who's the superstar of Dropbox, Drew? And then we got to meet with, Kane, the
group. What did they say about Excel?
All good stuff, of course. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, Excel pretty good at that. But it also started to open up our eyes a little bit to, holy shit, this network thing is true. And, you know, I just started to sow the seed. So, fast forward, Andrew put a term sheet to us at the end of 09. And
how quick was that?
So it was like a month or two after meeting. Like he and I started sharing, you know, talking and sharing and just doing stuff. And then Mark was like, nah, I'm not going to take VC money. Like, you know, he was still very much very skeptical of VCs. And, you know, because we were
Australian.
Yeah, we're Australian and we're cash flow positive, and Mark had been and Matt had been really successful entrepreneurs and seen lots of businesses take VC money and fail, and and we're, you know, that wasn't our focus. And so I just said to Andrew, look, we're not ready, you know, and but why don't we stay in contact? And so Andrew and I met a number of times over 2010.
Was it hard saying no?
It wasn't me saying no, so it was pretty easy. And so each time I met Andrew, he would be really spot on with his advice. Come early 2011, because of this inbound trade interest, Mark and Matt had decided they wanted to sell 99. And so that I was pretty worried about that. And to be fair, in 2010, we did get pretty close. And so I had to do a lot of advisory work inside a business. And I'd always told people, you've got to use external advisors. You can't do it yourself. And here I did it myself. And so part of that process meant that I got up to speed really quickly on the business. And so that's when Mark said, hey, you know the business as well as anyone now. I want you to run it. And so then he and I negotiated from about August through to January of 2011. Getting money out of founders is bloody hard. Getting titles was a little bit easier, but getting money was very hard. And so anyway, so became CEO officially in January of 2011. And then Mark was kind of setting me up there because he wanted to make sure that if a transaction happened, it was clear that I was going along with it and he and Matt were not.
Gotcha.
Right. And so wanted to create that separation. So
what changed from not doing a VC round to doing a trade sale to...
to doing that. Yeah. So I actually went to the basketball with Andrew with our kids and we're just sitting there and I'm like, mate, I need you to introduce me to some advisors. Like I'm not going to try and do it myself. Mark and Matt really want to do this. I want to support them. You know, I'd love to keep running the business. You know, I think we've got a huge opportunity ahead of us. We talked about some changes that we just made to the business, blah, blah, blah. And he just looked at me and goes, should we revisit this? And I'm like, yeah, maybe we should. And so what we agreed, and I cleared it with Mark and Matt. I'm like, hey, do you mind? And at the same time, Andrew, this is how good these guys are. He introduced me to two great advisory firms, you know, who would do a deal of our size, right? Like we weren't going to the top.
So he's giving you all the options. He's helping you assess what the best path is.
Exactly. And so I met with those people and was really impressed. I was like, okay, cool. He's introduced me to good people. And then in the background, I worked on a deck for him. And, you know, I said to Mark and Matt, hey, I'm going to go talk to these guys and just see. And I just sat with Ryan and Andrew. So Ryan's on my board now, Ryan Sweeney. He's a managing partner at Excel now. And we sat in a room in the city, like in a nondescript. We went to one of their portfolio company's offices. And I talked to them for about an hour and a half. And Ryan kind of looks at me and looks at him and goes, yeah, we should do this.
What changed Mark's?
Was approach. A good deal. You know, ultimately we could do it. Like we raised $35 million. Nearly all, you know, a big chunk of that went to the founders.
Gotcha.
So we actually, in the space of 6 months, we managed to do a deal that gave them more money in their pocket than they were prepared to accept in a trade sale. They got to retain significant stake in the business, and we got to put money in the business, and I got to have a crack at growing it, as did the team who were left behind.
Was it a strange thing for a VC firm to do?
I mean, at the time it was pretty, it's very atypical, but now it's more typical. Like, yeah. I think, but at that time it was odd.
Why do you think Excel did that?
And they were starting to experiment with this, the notion. They were traditionally been a VC fund and had done a lot of early stage. Like, they were Series A Facebook. I think they were Series A Dropbox.
Mm.
But they had raised another fund and they were starting to do more growth. And so Atlassian was an example, right? Atlassian was that first round that went into them. I'm pretty sure, you know, like, it was all secondary, right? Mm. So, like, you know, they were starting to do these deals. And so I think we were just an extension of that. But we were much earlier stage.
There seemed like, it felt like to me there was a bit of a wave there with US VCs incentivizing founders to take money off the table in the rounds that they were doing, where historically it wasn't that way.
That's right.
It was like a bit of a mentality around clear thinking, de-stressing from a financial point of view.
For sure.
And allowing people just to operate and try and create good companies.
Exactly.
Very passion-driven rather than...
Yeah, I mean, I think they had, but that was more of what they offered us in our first round. Mm. Like, originally, they were like, cool, let's put five in the business and Mark and Matt can take two out.
Yeah.
Which is much more like that, those sorts of deals were. Like, let's give the
traditional
founders...
Traditional deals, yeah.
Let's give the founders enough cash so that they can get the second mortgage off their house or they, you know, even maybe live mortgage-free so that they can really focus on the business. They weren't necessarily giving people enough money to walk away, which is kind of what our deal was. But what happened with our deal was they looked at me and said, cool, you're the CEO. We're backing you.
So what a great experience.
Yeah.
It sounds like, has that experience stayed pretty consistent through the period that, you know, because...
With Sam?
Yeah, with Excel.
Yeah. I mean, 5 years on. I mean, they're still the same guys. They're still the same firm. High integrity... you know, super helpful. I mean, you know, they definitely tend to invest in more mature businesses now. Like, you know, I don't, they're like other funds, they're not necessarily as hands-on or don't make you, you know, have a huge pool of resources, but they've got people for you. But strategically, super savvy. So, you know, two of the smartest guys.
The good times and the bad times, I'm sure, because it's been such a long relationship.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Hasn't all been, happy times, so to speak.
Yeah.
What's it been like in the...
Yeah, consistent. I mean, that's all you can ask for, right? Like, and I think that's what I tell people if they ask me about Excel is like, what you see before you take their money is what you get afterwards.
Mm.
And what I've learned, that's not always the case.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I've got plenty of mates who've taken money and are no longer CEO, right? Like, or founders who find themselves moving into different operating roles because of the pressure that the board's put on them. Whereas Excel are renowned for being founder friendly, and they pride themselves on that, and you know they've been really, really successful. So
yeah,
I mean they're at least in the top three global VC funds.
What advice would you give to an Aussie founder going to the US and looking to raise a round?
Yeah, I mean the key thing that I learned out of that process was as soon as you knock on their door, you're on the back foot. You have to do everything you can to drive them to your door.
And they're trawling the market 24/7 looking for deals.
Yeah, absolutely. They are.
So how do you get on that radar, do you think?
You get advocates. You get customer advocates. You get social uplift. You get content. You get media. You get traffic to your website. They are using sophisticated tools to basically scour the internet today to figure out who's starting to make waves.
Yeah.
And I think for Aussie founders, unless you're, you know, second time around and have had success, then they'll give you money based on you being really good.
Yeah.
But for most of us, we're unproven. And so when you're unproven, then you're going to have something that generally drives them. And so it could be that you're just a world-class scientist and your peers recognize you as that and that the work you're doing is world-class, then that sort of third-party recognition will start to drive people to your door.
Right.
Potentially. But, you know, generally in the worlds in which we operate, in sort of tech, consumer tech, SaaS, whatever it might be, then it's momentum.
Yeah.
And I think if you can get one or two of them to knock on your door, then you can parlay that into a bunch of meetings, right? You can then say to others, hey, I thought I'd reach out to you because I'm in town.
Hmm.
I'm coming to the Valley because a bunch of you hit me up I've got some meetings in Palo Alto. Are you interested in meeting me? And there is very much a lemming, like, oh.
A follower mentality.
Correct.
Yeah.
So
they can only analyze so much, so they're looking for.
They're looking for signals. Yeah. They're always looking for signals, and one of those signals is if other people are interested, then it could be something there.
Okay. Just pivot a little bit now. So you're in the US, you've done the round, you've got a couple of people, you know, in the business.
So we grew pretty quickly. So we grew slowly. So we went to 4, then we went to 6 because the US market, we needed more support staff, I think. And then, but, you know, in Australia, we kept the engineering team at about 10 or 12. I think when we did the deal with Excel, we had done some significant changes to our funnel in early 2011, which really started to improve our conversion rates, like significantly improved our conversion rates. And the business really started to take off. Again, right. After a relative, you know, like we'd had an okay 2010, but we really started to make a difference in 2011.
So you're an Aussie over there. You're trying to hire Americans. Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
I used a recruitment firm, Mitchell Lake. I had this.
You're smart there.
I had this eager Aussie recruiter hit me up at an event.
Corner you.
Yeah, that's right.
But how do you hire? How does an Aussie hire Americans?
I mean, it's not easy, as you know. I think having Excel made it a hell of a lot easier. So I think prior to Excel, we're only hiring junior positions, so it didn't matter. I mean, it did take me back when I was paying people $15 an hour to do customer support and they were asking me about our equity plan. You know, like I was like, wow, you really did reconfirm that I was in a gold mining town. You know what I mean? Like, and everyone was there to strike it rich. But these people asking for $15 an hour would be asking me like who our VCs were. And when we said we were self-funded, that was always a bit of a challenge. But so they were all junior roles. Because
they wouldn't have been used to self-funded businesses.
No, that's like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
But then once we took funding, then I had Excel's brand, and that was really, really powerful. I mean, they were known as a tier one VC. And so then that helped when I came to recruiting. And Excel were really, really supportive in the recruiting process early on. So when I was making those first hires of CFO and CMO, like starting to build out the senior team, you know, Andrew played a pivotal role in helping get those people over the line and helping me feel confident in the sorts of decisions I was making because, you know, I was first time CEO hiring senior people. And so, yeah, that was super beneficial. And so then from that, you know, then we could start filling out roles.
And then you had this team in Australia still existing in Melbourne, right? So how did you decide what I'm going to keep in America, what I'm going to build in America, what I'm going to keep in Australia?
Yeah, it was a good. We did have a little, like, we looked at each other in early 2011, and I talked to Excel about, like, do we try and bring the engineers over here now? Like, because we were this tiny company still, 25 people, right, split. And already I was knew the pain of time zones. But we just thought too expensive, too painful, and recruiting in that town is so hard, as you know. And so we just decided to continue to double down on our investment here.
Yeah.
We knew our engineers were, you know, world-class already. You know, like, you know, we had VC-funded competitors who couldn't keep their site up. Our site was up. You know, we were handling a lot more volume than they were. We continued to do, you know, to build really good product. And so we were pretty confident in the capability of the people here. Had a great team. I was blessed that, you know, Mark had hired some really great people when I joined. Jason Sehoy, who, you know, ran the Australia for me, and our CTO Lachlan Donald at the time. You know, Lox came over to, he wanted to scratch his valley itch. So he came over after we did the round. I think he moved over and early 2012, like to come join the management team. But those two were here on the ground in 2011. So it meant that, you know, we could recruit pretty effectively. And I just knew I was in good hands.
The hardest thing, I guess, for a lot of Aussies when they keep the engineering here is building product.
Yes.
Because that product function is very attuned to the valley.
Yes.
And does lack in Australia in some ways. Yes. So how did you manage that?
With great difficulty. It's still a challenge today. Like, my head of product, Ashish, is based in Oakland, and most of product and engineering is here. We do have a little bit of engineering in the States.
Mm. So what advice, again, would you give to a founder who's thinking about these sort of decisions at the moment?
You got to go in all in one way or the other. Like I think, you know, I don't, I'm always, a lot of founders want to run to the Valley, and you and I, you know, we spent a long time there, and it's the most competitive place on earth. And yes, the talent pool is amazing. Like it is the most talented place on earth too, right? Like it, the money brings amazing people and you get to see amazing stuff, but it is hyper competitive. And so I think if you've got a strong network in Australia and you've already built some critical mass, then it's, you know, my advice would be to continue to capitalize on that. I think if you're very early on, like I think they sort of start make folks who come over and they're four or five people, then moving everyone is kind of also a reasonable option.
Mm.
But just recruiting in that market's really tough. Mm. But, you know, plenty of people are doing it. I mean, yeah. It's a very transactionally based market. As you know, the talent moves around pretty quickly. Mm. And so you can get access to the sort of talent that's not as readily available here, but it's tough. I think, yeah.
Mm. Going back to your previous point about kind of creating waves and getting people to pay attention to you guys, I've always thought you guys have done an amazing job on the PR front. You know, you've always been out there.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that as a process of creating a brand and building a brand, not only attracting good talent, but, you know, funding and everything else, do you think?
Mm, yeah, no, I think it is. It is important. I mean, I think the most important thing you can do is have customer advocates first, right? So PR is kind of second. First is getting customers to talk about your product is the most important thing you can do. And we focused on that. So we've invested a ton. That's why the first four hires in America were customer support. I was answering the phone. You know, we were all answering the phone. Like we were really customer centric with that view that if we could get, we couldn't afford to market, but we could get good referrals. And we really enjoyed strong word of mouth because people were getting a great outcome. Now that was based on a whole lot of factors, but one of those things was just investing in that relationship, investing in good product experience and doing that. And then you magnify that with PR. You know, if you get a hook, we were lucky. I think we always underestimated a little bit the value of Matt. Matt was a super young entrepreneur out of Vancouver. So when Mark and Matt got together, Matt was 17. He started his first business at 15. Well, maybe first business at 13. I think Mark first met him when he was 15.
Wow.
Last 2 years of school, he was earning more money than his parents combined. And so we were able, like SitePoint was able to use Matt a little bit as like all those young entrepreneur lists.
Yeah.
Under 23, under 25, under 30. I don't know what Matt's now. 135. You know, like you can kind of like, you know.
And he's gone on to
Hired, yeah. Co-founder of Hired. Like, you know, Matt's a fantastic entrepreneur for sure. But part of that was, you know, helping tell a story.
Yeah.
And I don't think Australians, I don't think we ever really
understood. It's not a natural thing for us here, is it?
No, and we didn't really understand the value of it. But then Excel were sort of introduced me to PR people quickly and said, look, when we give you this round, you're going to, you know, you will create some stories and we should be ready and let's go.
So was that weird not being in that tall poppy kind of syndrome environment where, you know, you couldn't be too evangelical where, you know, in Australia, but compared to America where you've got to be super evangelical?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was still crap at it. I would meet people all the time and think, oh, wow, your business must be massive. And then it would be three people and I'd be, you know, talking about our small $10 million revenue business or whatever it was at the time. So, you know, I think, I mean, I don't think that's ever changed. I mean, but that's okay. I don't think you can change who you are. But you can invest in things to make people talk about you, to help people talk about you. So we've employed PR agencies. Wherever we've gone in the world, the first thing we do when we open a new market is employ an agency. You know, we figure out what our story angles could be. We get out, we tell those stories. I've been prepared to tell those stories. Mm-hmm. I don't want to tell stories about me. I want to tell stories about our customers, our designers, our team, our business.
So just quickly, how do you tell a good PR firm from a bad one?
It's a little bit like the way I hire recruiters. You know, if I'm not talking to the founder, I'm not that interested. So I've generally stayed pretty boutique. I've looked at what success they've had in the past. I reference them. And, you know, you're normally taking a flyer.
Yeah.
You know, that first, you know, you give them a 3-month contract. I generally like to set any PR engagement up with one specific thing in mind. So it'll be a launch, it'll be an announcement, it'll be product, you know, whatever it is. And so then you can kind of, you know, move on. We now have some agencies just on ongoing retainers, but they've kind of, we've got into a good rhythm together. And I think PR's changed a lot too. PR used to be a lot about big hits, and now PR's part of your content strategy. So you're constantly leveraging, you know, the sort of the outreach capabilities of a PR type person to just get your content shared or so, you know, yep. And you know, getting, it's not all about huge mastheads anymore. It is actually more about broader distribution. So it's kind of a real balance.
Okay. Now just talking about a little bit about the future, obviously a lot of, you're in the press again this week about moving back and mm-hmm. a potential listing on the ASX like mm-hmm. Aconex has done.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I mean, like, so me moving back was driven with the ASX in mind. We, you know, I suppose, you know, history of the business, we've done a strategic round with a Japanese business Recruit, which was great. We went into Japan. I think what came out of that process, which was successful, but, you know, ultimately it kind of reconfirmed to me that you cannot rely on anyone for your future. And so what we really wanted to achieve, we want to make sure that this business is a self-sustaining, independent business. And so the ASX represented a good opportunity for us to do that, as well as needing to ultimately provide liquidity options for our investors. Excel aren't in a hurry to, you know, they're long, long-term investors. Like, I think their average hold is 8 or 9 years. You know, at some point you've got to make something happen. And so rather than think about trade sale, you know, I started to fixate on this idea around, cool, well, let's, what if we became the acquirer? What if we could consolidate this industry? What if we could become this self-sustaining business and do that? So part of that was like, cool, move here, focus on getting the business back to profitability, start to understand the institutional investor landscape here, understand the media landscape, get back out in the media, start to create, you know, recreate and retell our story in the Australian market. We sort of neglected Australia for a long time because I, you know, was opening new markets. We've got a Berlin office. You know, we're in 8-9 countries around the world now. Like, so, you know, there was just a lot of activity. And so this was a chance to reestablish with the view that over the next 12, 24, 36 months, we'll list.
Right.
Right? Like, it's not happening
tomorrow.
It's
not immediate.
It's not immediate. The AFR makes it look like it's tomorrow. But, you know, and look, it may be sooner. There may be an opportunity to do a great transaction where it may speed things up. But ultimately, you know, we want to do it right. And we've got a ton to learn. We've got a lot of stuff that we want to do to the business. And, you know, running a private business is a lot easier than running a public one.
It's been an amazing journey, hasn't it? For you, I mean, this is another great challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like it's the next big unknown. And so I've just started talking to, you know, CEOs and of public companies and getting to understand, you know, what changes, what doesn't, how they've managed that. And just starting to think about all of those things. You know, there's a consistency to public life that's pretty different to private life. And so the best advice I've been given by numerous people to start practicing that consistency as a private company before you go public. And so we need some time to practice.
Makes sense.
And then, you know, I mean, anyone, we're clearly of the scale where we could IPO tomorrow, quite frankly, or backdoor in the miner or whatever's going on. It's the reverse backdoor today. You know, tech companies are going back to mining. you know, we're not interested in that. We want to be, you know, we aspire to be an Aconex or a WiseTech or, the ultimate, a Seek, you know, an REA, a car sales. Like, there's some great marketplaces that we've been built here and have real longevity as a public company. Because, you know, the work we do is pretty important. We think it's important, right? Like, the $200 million we sort of flippantly rolled off your tongue before, but, like, that's impacted a lot of people's lives. We get to meet designers on a daily basis who have built really sustaining, life-fulfilling careers on our platform. We meet entrepreneurs who Have got their brand, or you know, we got them started and they've gone on to create amazing things.
I was going to ask you, are there brands that stand out that you guys have helped create or launch or rebrand or?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean the ones that people might know here are like Docker, for example, pretty you know, if you're in the tech circles, you know them. Optimizely, if you're in the marketing circles. If you like to gamble, DraftKings, you know. But we've worked with a bunch of brands. We've seen success and we've seen failure. Yeah. But, you know, mostly we've helped lots of mums and dads too. You know, I love the fact that I can meet people all the time who have used us and also love us and say, oh, I've told my friends about you. And, you know, that's really rewarding. I think, you know, our next challenge is a new customer segment. You know, our best customers are agencies and corporates who use us on an ongoing basis. And so we're starting to go where the ongoing design need is. And so our platform needs to continue to evolve to do that. You know, we've spent a lot of time around curating our community, and we could spend a whole podcast just talking about marketplace dynamics. But so, you know, I still feel like there's a 10-year list of, you know, quite frankly, shit we want to get done. Right. And so that's part of the challenge, right? Like, just how do you get stuff done?
So if I was a young entrepreneur starting a business in the design field, what would you recommend? What areas do you see as the future?
I mean, I look, like everyone, I think there's going to be a lot of automation in our segment. We've seen, you know, obviously Canva's an amazing success story coming out of Australia, where they've built like tools. I think there's a lot of opportunity still in tools. I think what we're focused on at 99 is we're committed to helping people, right? Like, our whole ethos at 99 is helping people help people. Right. Like, so there's that connection. We're going to think about how can we take technology to make the people to people connection better. But I think if I was starting completely fresh, you know, one, anyone who's run a marketplace, you love them, but then you're also ultimately go, oh, I wouldn't want to do another one. Right. Like, 'cause there's a lot of challenges in having customers on both sides of the fence. I think, you know, but yeah, I think there's a myriad of opportunities in, you know, there's so many emerging markets around what we're going to see in augmented reality and VR and, you know, with 3D printing. Like, there's just, and the way the tools move, the devices in which they sit, you know, design is still very much dominated by Adobe and a desktop or a laptop and, you know, we're starting to see that evolve into the tablet, the phone, you know, the intersection of media, like, you know, design. Like, I think graphic design is going to morph. I think, you know, I think moving pictures and animation and all those things are significant areas of growth still. I think, you know, everyone I talk to asks me about video. So there's going to be a lot of opportunity in that market, which will then expand into the augmented versions of those, which will be perfect for us because it's a lovely intersection of design and, you know, video photography. Yeah.
Great. That's awesome. So I think we've been going a while now, so let's wrap it up. Pat, cool. I got a couple of questions here that we ask. Okay. Which I haven't shared with you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, cool. So they're going to be spontaneous.
Yeah.
Favorite book?
I really liked those series, Born to Run. It's a kind of inspirational. Yeah, it's a good book.
What about podcast?
Probably Marketplace on NPR. Like, I just love getting my snippet of American news.
Jimmy's NPR. Tech CEO.
Favorite?
Yeah.
I mean, look, I'm enamored with what Mike and Scott have been able to do at Atlassian. I think, you know,
it's incredible.
It is incredible. And I think that the way they've gone about it is almost unreplicable, but we can all learn a lot from them. And I think, you know, what's most impressive about both of them is the way in which they are reinvesting in the community and they're backing the next generation. And I think that's awesome for the ecosystem. You know, I think they're doing it a lot faster than I think we've seen traditionally.
If you were going to do a TED talk, what would it be on?
You know, I could talk about the global economy and going global and understanding the differences in different cultures. Like, I think that's been one of the things that's I've really enjoyed is our global reach as a marketplace. I think, you know, we've had customers in 215 countries now. You know, I think that's basically nearly everywhere. We've paid designers in 195. We've got offices in 3 now, but we've got presences in 8 or 9. You know, like, I feel pretty confident in that topic, but yeah.
I was always really impressed by how you settled into the US and San Francisco and style of the office and how I always felt it was a very American business, you know.
Every time
I walked in the office, yeah.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so that symmetry and that sort of alignment seemed like it was easy in some ways. You know, which is hard for.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's a different culture. It is a different culture. I mean, I think it's interesting. I think one of the things inadvertently, you know, this notion of radical candor is something that I've applied, rightly or wrongly. You know, I think it comes pretty natural to Australians. We kind of don't talk a lot of bullshit. I can be very direct.
Thanks for coming in and speaking to us today, Pat. We really appreciate the time and your candor. I know our listeners would have got a lot of positive learnings out of the last hour. And if you have any questions for us or for Pat, then just you can email me at faden@innovationbay.com. I want to let everyone know that we're running a bunch of events before the end of the year, all which are on our website, and we are still open for applications for our founder dinner in Melbourne at the end of November. So if you are looking for funding or product feedback, some advisors or client introductions, then submit a pitch. It is super simple. That's it. Thanks very much for listening, and look forward to speaking to you next time.